Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast, where we bring together the best medical minds, thought leaders, scientists, patients, and caregivers to inform and inspire the spondylitis community. I'm your host, Jill Miller, living my best spa life, knowing that how we meet today has the power to change everything going forward. Please note that the information provided in this podcast should not be considered medical advice. We do encourage all listeners to consult their healthcare professionals for medical concerns. Thank you for listening, and we hope you find our discussion today enlightening. Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast. Today, our guest is Carrie Kellenberger, a Canadian residing in Taiwan who navigates life with resilience despite grappling with two forms of spondyloarthritis, fibromyalgia, APS, and MECFS. As a dedicated writer, Carrie endeavors to illuminate the intricacies of life with chronic illness and disability, particularly for those affected by spondylitis. She transitioned from a globetrotter to a chronic illness advocate and full-time writer and brings much experience and insight to her advocacy work. As a seasoned patient advocate, Carrie leads support groups for women dealing with AS and fibromyalgia, leveraging her firsthand understanding to provide invaluable support and guidance. Her contributions extend beyond support groups. Carrie's chronic pain and fatigue expertise honed through her journey has earned her recognition as an award-winning blogger and sought-after speaker. Through her platform, mysevralworlds.com, Carrie extends a compassionate hand to individuals facing chronic illness, chronic pain, and disability, fostering a community of understanding and empowerment. Her journey underscores the profound impact of illness on multiple aspects of life. It shapes the diverse worlds she inhabits and fuels her commitment to supporting fellow patients on their path to resilience and empowerment. Carrie, good morning, good evening. How are you doing today? And welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. That was the nicest intro I think anyone has ever done for me.
Really?
I'm great now.
I feel like I was flipping all over it because it's late here.
No.
You're just getting up.
Excellent. Thank you so much for having me, Jill. It's a real pleasure to join you and the SAA for SpondyCast today. I'm so excited.
No, this is great. We're going to talk about going from globetrotting to patient advocate. Mm-hmm. And I do want to say first, I said earlier that like I'm grateful for the work you do. Your name has come up so many times, so I'm so thrilled to meet you through SAA, and the work that you've been doing as an advocate in this community, I think is highly impactful. So we would love to hear a little bit about your journey to diagnosis and how that impacted you. And we'll talk a little bit about how things have changed over time for you.
Okay, that sounds great. Things have changed a lot, unfortunately, as you know, with spondyloarthritis, it totally derails your life. And then you end up on new paths, new journeys. But that's the whole point, right? It's the patient journey.
Yeah, no, it is. It's, I often say sometimes it's the wildest roller coaster you will ever ride. So tell us about being diagnosed.
Oh, okay. So it was 15 years ago. So, you know, I've been doing a lot of, I guess, ruminating over the last couple of months, because it was 15 years ago that I got my diagnosis February 2009. So I guess, you know, I was just saying the other night to a friend of mine that sometimes I wish I could go back 15 years ago to when I didn't know so much about this disease, because then I wouldn't know what's coming. But then there's the other part of me that's glad that, you know, I've become an expert of sorts on it, because at least I can try to head things off and try to navigate it ahead of time and be a little bit prepared. But when I got my diagnosis in 2009, at the time, I didn't think that I had a typical presentation for Axe Spa. It actually presented in my knees, and I had a lot of swelling in my joints in general. And then when I ended up watching Dr. Gensler at the ACR convergence in November, she had mentioned a couple of case studies that seemed to mirror exactly my journey. So it was nice to hear that validation. But anyways, my joints swelled up in 2009. I was having problems where I couldn't put any weight on my feet, or I'd wake up and I couldn't turn my head, or I couldn't lift my arm or anything. And I thought, that's weird. And as an athlete, as a very serious athlete, I just attributed it to working out or maybe doing something wrong. Like, my dad was a coach, so I was in everything from basketball to downhill racing and figure skating. And I spent a lot of time in the gym and a lot of time in the weight room. And I just kept passing the buck, thinking, oh, maybe I lifted wrong or something like that. And then it was just really easy to dismiss it and blame it on something else. And then, of course, 2 months before I got married, it flared up again. And then a week before my wedding, it flared up. And that's when I realized it was really serious. I got married. And then 2 months after my marriage, 2009, I woke up and I couldn't walk. My knees were huge. We ended up going to ER because the swelling wasn't going down. I was using RICE protocol at the time, trying to get the swelling to go down on my own. And my husband was like, no, there's something wrong. We have to go to ER. So when I went to ER, of course, they thought I had rheumatoid arthritis because of the joint swelling. And when they told me about a week later that I had something that they thought was called ankylosing spondylitis, I was like, what? That doesn't, what's that? Well, thank goodness it's not rheumatoid arthritis, at least. And why do I ever regret saying that? Because, ankylosing spondylitis, just as bad as rheumatoid arthritis. And yeah, it was a shock. And I wish I'd known what was coming, but also I'm glad that my hospital and the rheumatologists that I landed with were aggressive, and they were understanding. It was interesting having to do that in a second language, because of course our hospitals here, the first language here is Chinese, Mandarin Chinese. But luckily I landed with a rheumatologist whose English was quite good, and he was great. I really wish that he hadn't ever retired a few years later, because when he retired, I call that period of life the troubles.
Oh,
yeah.
And this wasn't long after you moved to Taiwan, right?
I guess in retrospect it wasn't. I mean, sometimes a year can feel like a long time, and then sometimes it can't. So I moved to Asia in 2003 and lived in China for 3 years. And that's where I met my husband, who is from Iowa. And we ended up moving to Taiwan in 2006. And then I had my diagnosis by early 2009. So I had about 6 years of really intense globetrotting, and then a couple of years after diagnosis to do a little more globetrotting before AXSpA said, no more travel for you, at least not the way we were traveling.
Right. And so over time, like when you got that diagnosis, what was the immediate, like, visceral response is the best way I can describe it?
I think it was relief, because I had a name for all of the weird things that were happening to me. Up until that point, doctors had been very dismissive of things that I had brought up in medical appointments. You're too young to have that kind of pain. You shouldn't be having this kind of fatigue. There was underlying suggestions that I was hypochondriac. So I had a name for this disease, and I felt relief. And it's so funny, because, you know, when you go to a doctor, you expect once you get a diagnosis, they're going to treat you, and then you are done and you're ready to go and you're back to living your life. So I guess I was very naive. I thought that I would begin treatment and that would be the end of it. The swelling would stop and I'd go back to my normal busy life. I didn't understand that I needed to make a lifestyle change or any of the other changes that I've made in life. So at that point, I guess my immediate reactions were relief that I had a diagnosis.
I think a lot of people have been there, especially women, right? You finally put a name to all the things. And you also were diagnosed with fibromyalgia. And tell me, what is MECFS?
Okay, so ME/CFS is myalgic encephalomyelitis. It's also known as chronic fatigue syndrome. When my AS came out of remission in 2012, I started having other symptoms that didn't seem to be AxSpA AS related. What do you prefer, by the way? Do you prefer AxSpA or AS?
You know what? I prefer whatever makes everybody happy. Like whatever makes you happy. I mean, I say I have AS. Some people look at me. Sometimes I go, well, it's non-radiographic, you know, and you're just, I've been corrected. I've been uncorrected. So I think whatever works for you, right?
It's, okay.
And I'll probably get in trouble for that because it is technically axial spondyloarthritis. I like SPA.
Okay. I will use axial spondyloarthritis. So we could probably have a whole other conversation on AS.
Maybe AxSpA. This should be a whole episode.
I'm going to try and focus on AxSpA. But when I got my disease, it was AS. So sometimes I slip up. But anyway, so myalgic encephalomyelitis is chronic fatigue syndrome, and fibromyalgia is, well, you know what fibro is.
Yes.
I came out of remission in 2012. I had some additional symptoms that were coming up that didn't fit AxSpA. Mainly the fatigue was crushing and my pain was ramped. And if you have experienced fibro in any way, then you know that AxSpA pain and fibro pain are very different things. So I got the fibro and the ME diagnosis in 2014. After they realized that I had a lot of other problems that were going on. And as it turns out, that was just the beginning of the cascade effect with axial spondyloarthritis or with spondyloarthritis. They loved party together, as we all know. So after that, the diagnoses just came rolling in. And I just landed in Taiwan after going home for the first time in Canada with an APS diagnosis. So that's antiphospholipid syndrome. And basically that means I've got sticky blood. So I didn't even know that was on the radar for AxSpA patients. I only learned about it because I flew and ended up with a blood clot and had to be brought off the plane in medical distress. And when I got to my rheumatologist, he's like, why didn't you take the prednisone? And I'm like, but it clearly wasn't AxSpA. So not in a million years was I thinking it was an autoimmune blood disorder or anything like that. So that's also connected to AxSpA as well. So that has been my current focus of research over the last year. Those diagnoses, they just keep on coming in.
Yeah. Well, and the fatigue piece is interesting. We had Dr. Cordy, I don't know if you listened to him, out of the Netherlands, who he has AxSpA, but he's also a neuroscientist who has spent his career researching fatigue in people with AxSpA. And he described it, and you said it a little bit earlier, of like the family that SAA brings together. But he described something for me and I was like, oh my gosh, I've never heard that it's said that way. And then you feel like you're with family. But he had talked about fatigue or chronic fatigue or cognitive fatigue being the back end of an inflammatory event, which to me was enlightening. And
yeah.
I don't know if that applies to you. I'm not a medical professional, but...
Me neither. I mean, I do get autoimmune fatigue from AxSpA flare-ups, but the ME was triggered by, I think that I've had ME and fibro. I've clearly had all of these diseases for a long time. I had an EBV diagnosis, which is Epstein-Barr. It's also known as mono when I was 14. And I think that was the trigger that kind of switched everything on for everything else, because after that, when I look back through my journals, because I'm an extensive journaler, the dots just started connecting. And ME itself, the hallmark figure with ME or chronic fatigue is, it's not actually fatigue so much, it's PEM, which is post exertional malaise. And what happens is I will do an activity, and if I push through my energy envelope, the baseline amount of energy that I have per day or steps per day, then I enter a PEM crash, which happens at the 24 to 72 hour mark. And it's, I can't even really describe a PEM crash, Jill. It's like, I call them gray days. It's just a profound weakening of everything and no energy. Like I can't even pick up a glass of water. It's just, I just need to be quiet, keep the lights off, no sound or anything like that, and just try and rest and let my body recover from it. So I'm really, really careful about pacing and trying to make sure that I stay within my energy envelope. So ME is also another topic that we could have a large conversation on, but I will say it does pop up a lot in my women support groups. So I run a Facebook group for women who have AS and fibromyalgia. We haven't changed the name yet. And I am constantly amazed. There's over 3,000 women in that group, and the number of women that have AxSpA, fibro, and ME is shocking. It's just shocking. Really? And they all figure it back to mono. Now we're seeing it's because of COVID.
Yeah. Well, then there is some talk, right, that COVID might be one of the things that catalyzes more research on these things, because now the whole world has had to deal with the autoimmune system. Okay, journaling. You mentioned you're a journaler. Tell us My Several Worlds. This is fascinating. I read a little bit, but what inspired you to start this, and what is how has this evolved over time for you?
Oh gosh. Okay. So that is a huge question. Okay. So in general, I'm going to attribute my journaling habit to my grandma Louise, who also fostered my love of books. She gave me my first journal when I was 6 years old. It was a beautiful white leather journal with gold embossed writing on the front of it and had a lock and key. And she said, you know, just answer one question or write one thing in your journal every day that made you happy. So she got me into the gratitude practice really early in life. And that habit has stuck with me. And then, of course, the reward with her was, I'll bring you a book next time I see you, but you better show me what you wrote in your journal so I know you're writing. So she got me into
that. Mother.
Yeah, she was awesome. She was the first educated woman in our family to get a degree. She was a librarian. She knew the way to a child's heart. I am a natural introvert and bookworm at heart, and I love writing. So she really got me into that habit of journaling and writing every day. And when I moved to China, we didn't have any kind of, blog. I mean, we had MySpace, but that was about it. So I was still writing in my hand journals, and I've got stacks of them at home. Like if you ask my mom, she's like, there's at least two tubs full of journals going back to when you were 6 years old, and I'm 49 now. So that's a lot. And I still write in my journals by hand, despite, I just like that habit of just
writing
on in person.
I'm with you.
I'm prolific on my blog. So eventually, when WordPress came out, I'm like, oh, I'm going to move my handwritten journals online. And that way people can see what our travels are like and what my life was like in China. And I named the site after my favorite book and the last book that my grandmother gave me, called My Several Worlds. And it was written by an American missionary named Pearl S. Buck. I don't know if you've heard of her or not, but she's a fantastic author. So I really liked Buck's message of being someone who straddles two different worlds. She talked about being in the small white Presbyterian world of her parents' missionary missions. And then, of course, living in the great, big, crazy, wild, not so clean world of China. So initially, I started my site off of that concept, and My Several Worlds was launched in January 2007, and it was initially a travel and culture website, and it was supplementing the writing that I was doing for magazines like Travel and Leisure Asia at the time. And then when I got sick and it became apparent that I wasn't going to be traveling as much and my lucrative traveling career was starting to slow down, I was like, where am I going to take this? Like, I've spent all this time putting all of this energy into this travel blog and now I can't travel. And I reread the book. I went through the book again and then I was like, wow, okay, so Pearl Buck also had a daughter who was disabled. So she also lived in the world of disability. And I'm like, well, if she can do it, I can do that too. So that's when I made the transition to full-time writing about chronic illness and disability. And specifically, I got started on spondyloarthritis.
That's amazing. How old were you when your grandmother gave you that book?
I went to China when I was 27 and she hit every secondhand bookstore she could find because it was out of print, right? Buck wrote that book, I think in the 1850s or something. So I was 26 and I still have it. It's right there. It's in my prized area of books. It's on display. It's tattered. It's worn. It's been to every country with me. And it reminds me of her every day. So
that's amazing. So as you are doing your writing, I think it's very, there's a lot of you in it now that I've met you. But what are the things that you think are misconceptions that people have about living with these conditions?
Well, there's so many, right? I mean, we could have like six different conversations just on the things we're covering today. But the number one thing that I obviously want to highlight, especially because when I got my diagnosis in 2009, nobody had ever heard of AxSpA. They hadn't even heard of AS. They didn't even know what ankylosing spondylitis was. That myth that it was a men's disease really affected me and my treatment. And, you know, in retrospect, landing with the rheumatologist that I did, my diagnosing rheumatologist, like he was so kind and so patient. He took me through my imaging scans. He showed me what regular scans look like and then showed me what my scans look like. And he said, you see all of this cloudy white here, that's inflammation. So I had seen this with my own eyes. And then when I went to, when he retired, I ended up going to a different rheumatologist. I did not stay with his replacement because I didn't like her mannerisms or her explanations. She just wasn't giving me any kind of, she wasn't giving me any doctor love. So I went to a different rheumatologist. And I should not have stayed with him as long as I did. He just flat out said, you can't have AS. Only men get AS. Women don't get AS. And he said, I've seen a lot of young, anxious women like you. And you've got fibromyalgia and ME. And he ended up taking my AxSpA diagnosis off my paperwork, which was hugely devastating for me. Like, why had they been treating me for this disease for 5 years? And then suddenly this doctor decides women don't get AS, so we're not going to treat you for that anymore. And that was the part of the troubles that I mentioned earlier.
I'm going to go out on a limb, and I don't say this very often, but like your comment around, I've met a lot of anxious women.
Yes.
I was there, and I think probably I would love to take a poll of like women in the community who have heard that. Mm-hmm. It makes me so angry.
Yeah.
The fury just got up. I had a doctor who was like, and I had a doctor walk in the room and he said, I don't know what to tell you, you have fibromyalgia. And I said, no, I don't actually meet like the DSM criteria for fibromyalgia. And he's like, well, then you need to get over your anxiety because I don't know what's wrong with you. And I was, how are we still in a world where that happens?
Yeah.
I'm sorry that happened to you. That's horrible. After 5 years of being treated and you were responding to treatment, right? For the most part.
I was, so he took the diagnosis away and then put me on a bunch of medications that I never should have been on. The medications landed me in ER at the end of 2015. I was just a mess. So I ended up moving to another hospital, and that's where I was finally able to access biologics, and I should have been on those biologics years before. Like my ESR and my CRP rates were high enough that I should have been on biologics 3 years before I actually got access to them. So during that time, a lot of, I ran into a lot of problems with, I mean, there's irreversible damage to my joints. Like many women, I waited over 10 years for my diagnosis. And then on top of that, I've met doctors that are like, oh, well, women don't get IS, so it must be something else, or it must be you.
Yes.
It's me. And I'm like, if you treat the pain and get me out of the pain, you're not going to be seeing anxiety. You're just going to be seeing normal carry. So it was tough. I had to fight to get my AS or AxSpA diagnosis added back. And then when I got my psoriatic arthritis diagnosis, I see this doctor pop up in Taiwan all the time on Taiwan YouTube videos. And I just want to shake the man. I really want to ask him, you know, like, you'd know now that the ratio is 1:1 for women and men, right?
Yeah,
like,
clearly great.
You know that now.
Yeah, that's crazy. Okay, so let me ask you this. I don't know that I've talked to anyone who's living in Asia with AS before. So how has living in Taiwan influenced, do you think, I know you haven't lived here with it, so, but how are you managing, you think, differently than traditional? Is there an Eastern medicine component to this, or thoughts?
Okay. So obviously the biggest change for me is I'm navigating a healthcare system in a second language in a foreign country. So a lot of people have asked me, you know, why didn't you go home? And there are two reasons why I didn't go home. The first one is I didn't know how disabling or bad my disease was. I had no idea because there was no information and I didn't think it was going to get this bad. But the second and most important reason is that Taiwan is my home. This is where we chose to build life and where we launched our business. So our healthcare system here is actually very good. We have the number one healthcare system in the world, and I'm happy to outline a little about how our health system works in a few minutes if you want to learn more about it. But yeah, we've got Eastern and Western medication here, or Eastern and Western approaches. And I've learned some tips and tricks to navigating my appointments. Sometimes they're for about 8 years, they were kind of more in Chinese than English. I have found that I need to be very persistent and vocal about managing my healthcare here. I'm sure that I come across as really annoying, and doctors hate to see me coming in Taiwan because I'm not a Taiwanese patient. Taiwanese patients are typically, there's a cultural attitude between doctors and patients here, right? The doctor is right. The patient is not to question the doctor. And I don't fall into that category. Like, why are you deciding this? How did you find this out? So I'm sure they think, oh gosh, here she comes again when I enter my hospital appointments. But, you know, if I come across as annoying, that's okay. Because I'd rather have answers than not have any at all. And I have found a rheumatologist now who seems to actually really like the fact that I'm annoying with my questions. And I actually saw him last week and he's like, oh, wow, you've got lots more to read about now, don't you? And I'm like, yes. So he knows. But yeah, I found I need to be persistent and vocal. I have also found that when you're dealing with foreign healthcare systems and you're not dealing with it in your native language, there are tips and tricks that you can use to advocate for yourself. When I first got my diagnosis in 2009, we didn't have Google Translate working so well, but I can honestly flip the translator on my phone. And if I can't say it, I can switch it over to translate on my phone and pull it up in simplified Chinese and make sure that they understand what I'm asking or what I want.
Oh, that's a great one.
It's a good one. Yeah, there's, I don't have too many problems with doctors. It's the nurses that I tend to struggle with more because they are not usually as educated with English as the doctors are. All of our rheumatologists speak some degree of English. So yeah, Google Translate helps a lot. I also use a calendar with, like, on my phone. It's not even an app. You can literally go into your calendar on your phone and tap the day on the calendar and then enter an emoji. And the emojis speak volumes, right? So I can put a little crying face for when I've had a bad day, or I could put a happy face, or I could put a foot on my calendar to show that I've gone for a walk. And that's an instant visual for my doctor and for my nurses to look at and say, oh, so you've been crying all month. You've had a bad month. Your disease has been very active. Or, oh, you got out and you got some walks in, or you got some exercise in, and we could see that you've tracked all of this. So that's been helpful as well. And then, of course, I have documented everything. So I've got color-coded binders. I've got color tabs for when I got my diagnoses. I've got color tabs for the medications that I've tried. I've got color tabs for my test results. And that way, if any doctor comes to me and says, hey, we want you to try this, I could flip to my binder and say, I tried it here and here was the result. And no, I don't want to try that medication again.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I just had a conversation and they were like, well, did you try this? I was like, yeah, that's a long time ago. And I remember not liking it. They're like, well, what happened? And I was like, well, I don't know, but I didn't keep track.
I don't even put the binders in when I first meet with a new doctor so that they know I mean serious business, because it's been 15 years. The binders are like a couple of inches thick and they're all organized. Like I've gotten all of my medical records printed out from all my hospitals and then organized them all by date. So, I mean, my husband will pull them out of my backpack. He'll be like, do you want to see? This is the history. Bam, bam.
That is great, though. I love the emoji hack.
Yeah, the emoji hack is so easy. Like, the nurses think it's really cute, too, because they could tell right away, wow, okay, you've had a bad week.
Maybe that's where the Baz dye is going.
Maybe.
So talk a little bit about about Taiwanese medical care.
Okay, so I'm going to start by saying that Taiwan medical care, our healthcare system, is excellent. As I mentioned, it's the number one healthcare system in the world. We have held on to that number one spot for 5 or 6 years now. And the reason why it's listed as one of the number one healthcare systems in the world is because it's free and easy to access. So 97% of our population has access to healthcare and specialists and dental. Everything's covered. And our healthcare is run through the government. So it's known around the world as being a hugely successful healthcare system because of its costs and efficiency. And interestingly enough, the person who started healthcare in Taiwan is a Canadian. So his name was Dr. George Leslie Mackay. And he came to Taiwan in 1871 and started laying the groundwork for the development of Western medicine in Taiwan. And I got to explore a lot of his history and the work that he did in Taiwan through my work with the Canadian Chamber of Commerce in Taiwan. So he was the first doctor to open hospital and dentistry practices here in Taiwan. And eventually our national health insurance program launched in 1995, and it features mandatory enrollment, a single payer system, and premiums that are financed. So an example would be the patient pays 25% each month out of their paycheck, and the amount that you pay is based on your salary. The employer matches it 25%, and then the government picks up the other 50%. And we get these cards, they're called NHI cards, that are smart cards. And they provide an information highway network that are connecting patients to healthcare providers and the government. So with my health card, I can go into any clinic or hospital and book in to see a doctor or a specialist immediately. There are small clinics all around the island. If I've got a cold or a flu or an ear infection or something, I can go right up the road, wander into the clinic. I pay the equivalent of, it's 150 NT, which is about $5 US. I have never waited more than 30 minutes to see a doctor, and then they hand your prescriptions to you as you leave your appointment. And then booking in with specialists is also really easy. You can go online, you look up the specialists that you want to book in with. Typically the wait time for a specialist is 1 week or 2 weeks. Tests are arranged quickly. Some days I do blood work and I can get my results within 2 hours. Some days I do x-rays the day that they're ordered. And the most I've ever had to wait for an ultrasound or an MRI is 2 weeks. So those tests are also really cheap. And specialist appointments are around $20 per visit. And that also includes my medications. And I see my rheumatologist once a month. So that's all the good stuff that happens with healthcare here.
That's interesting. How are outcomes? Are they better than like US or?
I would say, yeah, because I have easy access and almost instant access to my doctor. I've got a doctor that talks to me and is free with information. So that's been going really well. There are drawbacks to the system. Obviously, if you've got a, I don't want to say rare, because we know that axSpA is not a rare disease. We know it's just as prevalent as rheumatoid arthritis. But in their eyes, the government eyes, it's still not a well-known disease. So if you've got a disease that isn't well-known, obviously that's going to affect your access to medications and access to specialists. The other huge drawback that I had with the healthcare system here was I had to wait years for the government to bring biologics to Taiwan. And then I had to wait years to get access to biologics. And then I had to wait to get coverage for them because they weren't included in healthcare coverage. So for about 3 years, I was spending around 32,000 NT per month, which is about 1200 US for my okay. injections. And then I was basically, I fought the government, but I was petitioning the government for assistance with coverage. And I didn't want full coverage. Like I could afford to handle a couple of $100 US each month. It was the 1200 that was killing us.
Right.
But eventually my disease spun out of control in 2022 and my lab skyrocketed and they were like, okay, yeah, she really needs help. And I won coverage for it. So my payments in 2022 went from 32,000 NT, which is 1200 US per month, to 180 NT, which is $5 for my injections.
Oh my goodness.
That was huge. But it took a long time to get there. Like, I feel like that was like the great battle that I fought in the last decade. Now I'm fighting for disability coverage.
Now you're fighting for everyone else. It seems like yeah. The first one through the door opens the door for the rest.
Yeah. But you know, you've asked about Eastern medications. So I'll cover this very
quickly. Yeah. Just like Eastern treatments.
Yeah, I haven't been doing a lot recently because I kind of feel like I ran the gamut with Eastern medications during my early years with my diagnosis, but everything is available and covered under the healthcare system as well. So you can do traditional Chinese medicine here if you want. Cupping is widely available at all hospitals. Acupuncture is widely available at all hospitals. Acupressure is available. Gua sha, which is scraping, is also available. And that's all run through the healthcare system as well. So if you wanted to go and try any of those things, it's still the same price. You'd pay $5, book your appointment, and then have your treatment. The only thing I feel is really, really, really out of date is the physical therapy program here. It's like it's stuck in the 80s.
Really? Mm-hmm. I sometimes feel like that about the US too.
I have nothing to compare it to, but it feels like they've just put it together for seniors and it's a very dismal, dismal place.
I would say here it's not that bad. It's my biggest bone of contention with it is it's just a, it's let's get you to, it's treat them and street them.
Yeah.
And not, we've had a couple spondylitis focused physical therapists on who are like, physical therapy is a part of your treatment as you move through your life. And I think that's, I've gotten to the point where physical therapy costs more out of pocket than actually like just paying someone to do the work, like to be a trainer or whatever. It's yeah. I mean, and I wouldn't say it's, maybe it's not stuck in the '80s. Cause I know in the '80s we couldn't get like even anything.
The '80s were pretty cool.
You and I are rounding the same decade here shortly. I'm probably a few weeks ahead of you. So, okay. So we're going to run out of time here soon, but I want to hear, you do so much for so many people. What are the biggest pieces of advice or messages that you, you share when you're supporting other people or talking with others with these diseases?
Oh gosh. Okay. So that's a big one too, because I do write about a lot of different topics. To newly diagnosed patients, I encourage you to reach out to veteran patients for guidance. Veteran patients are usually connected to nonprofits and organizations like the SAA. Studies have shown that patients overwhelmingly learn from other patients. So it's okay to reach out and ask for help and information. Thankfully, we have a lot of great patient leaders in our space that are working with organizations like the SAA. And they tend to have the most up-to-date information. And it's really validating to hear someone else say, me too, just like you and I have connected through this conversation. I mean, we found a lot of points that we were really able to commiserate on together. So that's my number one tip, is reach out to veteran patients and don't be afraid to ask for help or run something by them, because hearing that somebody else is going through the same thing you're going through is hugely validating. Yeah. And then you know you've got support. And of course, obviously, you become a member of the SAA, no matter where you are in the world. Anyone who knows my story knows that I met the folks at the SAA in 2009. To this day, I'm still shocked that they were willing to help a Canadian in Taiwan so many years ago. They were great at sending me information. They were great at getting me connected with other patient leaders. That's how I met a number of people in the AXSpA space. And their family, right? The SAA is spreading its mighty wings and connecting us and making sure that we're all together and feeling supported. And my final piece of advice is keep on going. You've got this.
Yeah,
you're not alone in what you're going through.
I think that's a big one. Well, thanks for the plug there. We like that. But I'm with you. I mean, I wouldn't be sitting in this chair probably just in the state I'm in a positive way without having met with the SAA. So
they're family, you know, there's,
yeah, it is a family.
Reminders, like there are always better medications on the horizon and there is always better information coming. The folks to follow is the SAA, as far as I'm concerned. I can't wait for the Spondy Summit coming up next month.
Yeah,
you know, I'm going to learn a lot more interesting information there. And it's great to hear that you've been covering some of the speakers over the last little while that have been featured in the Spondy Summit.
Yeah, there's so much information. And yeah. I love a story more than anything, but I also love research and like, let's get this done. All right. Well, on that note, thank you so much for this. And hopefully we will get to do this again. But I'm grateful for the work you do. I know you do so much advocacy work and keep going. You're amazing.
So are you. Thank you so much for your time. And thank you for staying up so late tonight to speak with me.
I am going to hit the pillow. I've been yawning in the background, as you can see. All right. Well, on that note, that is a wrap. And we look forward to having you back.
Terrific. I look forward to it too. Thanks so much. Very much.
SpondyCast was made possible by donations from the Spondylitis Association of America's individual members and our show's corporate sponsor, AbbVie. Since our founding in 1983,
The Spondylitis Association of America has been the face, voice, and leading nationwide nonprofit educating, empowering, and advocating for people living with spondyloarthritis. Through our extensive work with patients, the medical community, and partners, we provide information and resources to help people impacted by the disease live better lives and champion research to find a cure.